I'm Eric Kirk.
And I'm Dave Frank.
And this week we're going to discuss last night's election results, the shutdown and SNAP benefits, and whether or not the president is suffering dementia. Good evening. You're either watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. My name is Eric Kirk.
And I'm Dave Frank.
And we are discussing national news of the day, a national political news of the day, and the big news is the election. Now, I think about a dozen states had some elections. Most states don't have elections on the odd years. California had one because it was a special election. But we'll just start off by saying that if this was any type of a referendum on Donald Trump, it looks bad for him. Now, he's saying that the bad results, and we'll go over the bad results or the good results for the Democrats. He's saying that the reason that it went so badly is he's not on the ballot, and because of the shutdown, which is like, yeah, probably part of it. But there were 13 statewide offices up for grabs yesterday, and the Democrats won every single one. There was the governor's race in New Jersey, governor's race in Virginia had been expected. Maybe they would be close. They weren't. They were blowouts. And then there was the mayor's race in Mamdani, with Mamdani being the Democratic Party candidate up against Mr. Sliwa and who was a Republican candidate, and an independent named Cuomo, who received Trump's endorsement at the last minute. So I'm not sure whether that helped him or hurt him. But suffice to say, maybe we should start closer to home. Proposition 50, which was basically redistrict, set aside our, as Dave keeps referring to it, gold standard independent commission maps, and at least until 2030, well, actually, the measure carries it to 2030, we will be using maps that are gerrymandered to create enough Democratic majority districts to offset what is expected to be the five House seat gains in Texas. Although there's some questions about that after last night's election. But Dave, you want to tell us what happened in California?
Sure. Yeah. So the results, we received them pretty early along, maybe within a half hour of the polls closing. And as of now, the most recent numbers we see is that the outcome voted yes in favor of the redistricting, about nearly 64% to just over 36%. So it's a really large advantage there in favor of Governor Gavin Newsom's plan for redistricting to try to create these five Democratic seats. And truthfully, what that means is that there are five Republican sitting Congress members whose districts are being redefined in such a way that they really can't win re-election, or it'll be very challenging, certainly at the least. So that's
for instance, our own district. We are going to thin our 707 district to slide down the coast, but we're not going to have Santa Rosa, but we'll have Marin County. And we are extending over the hills into Shasta County and Modoc and Siskiyou. And that means that Doug LaMalfa is probably going to be defeated by Jared Huffman in 2026.
Yeah, and in addition to our district being affected that way, there are like three other districts. So 1, 2, 3, and 6, those are all congressional districts here in Northern California where there's going to be some shuffling going on. And so challengers and incumbents both are going to be, as of like this morning, are already really starting to scramble a little bit to kind of figure out who's going to run where. We're not going to get into the nitty gritty on the specifics here today, but no. That includes things like two Republican Congress members having to compete in a new district where they think they have a chance. But in reality, the turnout was such that we can see that this didn't happen in a vacuum. So despite the fact that there's going to be these five affected districts, there might be more lessons. We're going to talk more about this when we talk about other races across the country. But early observations are that there's been an increased turnout compared to what was expected. And in addition to that, people were predicting about 10%. Yes was beating no in the late polling, but that margin now we're talking about closer to like 27%. Exactly. So it fits the if Republicans got the vote out and Democrats got the vote out, and the ratio is 2-1, that's about how the outcome appears to be at this point, with about close to 80% of the votes already counted.
I think it's going to actually go up to 65, if not 66%, based on the typical demographics of the late votes being counted. But then again, there was nothing typical about this election. This was very different. This was not just Democrats being partisan. Democrats represent 45% of the electorate in registered Democrats in California. Republicans, I think somewhere between 25 and 30%. The rest are either independents or members of other parties. And the Democrats could not have gotten a result like this alone. That means that there are people who are paying attention, who are not necessarily Democrats, who are concerned about what is happening in other states and what this is going. That is an awareness, because I think that I even talked to some Democrats who were going to vote against it because they just don't want to give up our great 707 district and the gold standard. They want to keep it out. They want to keep politics out of the process as much as possible. And we will get it back in 2030, unless politics are still such a state that we end up passing another one. I hope that's not the case. I really didn't like having to vote for this one. I don't like this at all. But this is not, they did it first, so we're going to do it to get even. This is an attempt to offset what might happen in Texas. Now, I think they may have a problem in Texas, but we'll talk about that. But this was resounding. I mean, there is no doubt that this was the will of the majority of people. And this was not a low turnout election. They're expecting that about 11 million have done. Now, I don't think it's quite as high as the recall, but it's not low. It's not insignificant. We're going to be, at 40% turnout, some 50% turnout. Certainly there was high turnout in those Republican areas in LaMalfa's district against it.
Yeah, and if you look at the map, you can see it'll show on a county by county basis, the margin, whether it was plus 20, plus 30, plus 40 for yes and no. And it's clear that the affected communities in Northern California did show up to vote, vote their interests. But I want to say before I forget, I know we've been going for a little bit here. I think it's the reason that I think there are implications nationwide for how this vote turned out is because we have to talk about, two things really. One, what has inspired people? What's the climate? And it's really at a fundamental level. It's the presidential Trump's administration, their impact on people's lives. For example, government funding, job cuts, immigration crackdown, corruption, authoritarian creep, expansion of military actions. So in light of that, what we saw nationwide is that there was some pushback for example, in Virginia, like every county had an increased shift Democrat versus towards the Democratic candidates compared to the last election.
In California, Fresno voted for the initiative. Again, I'm just going to put it out there and we can kind of weave it into the discussions, but I think the Latino vote has been a big effect. I think when we see these changes, we're going to see a big, huge shift in the Latino vote. from away from Trump of the Latino men who were impressed with him whatsoever for whatever reason. They're not so impressed with him now. And I think that's why we had why you see some counties in the valley. Fresno is a Republican, got a Republican mayor. You know, that whole that district voted for it, and other parts of the other side of the hill as well. Definitely not the ones that were directly affected, as you point out. They tended to be the strongest ones against. But I think what we're going to find here in Virginia and New Jersey. Is that the Latino vote and possibly certain elements of the Asian vote have completely turned around from 2024.
So Tip O'Neill famously said, he's Speaker of the House, that all politics are local. And I think that, you know, for me, one of the big takeaways so far as we try to unpack what happened across the country last night is that there are, you know, people can read into their own communities, their own states, you know, something a little bit more personal impact than maybe what we're hearing from the talking heads, so to speak. Lots of people are saying, you know, Mamdani, who's going to be the mayor of New York City, he won handily. He beat the Titan legacy family of former Governor Cuomo. That this is showing that his, you know, Democratic Socialists of America background, that's sort of in alignment with the Working Families Party, these progressives, that this is the future. This is how you attack sort of legacy politics head on. You go, you know, what Mamdani did was he and his people, they ended up getting like 90,000 volunteers and knocked on 3 million doors and made 4 million calls. And you know, from the day of last election all the way through to today, they were full court press. So I was on a call with some of his staffers last night where they were talking about, you know, what their strategy was and secret to their success. And really, they said that this wasn't about style. This wasn't about pick your audience. This wasn't about, you know, threading the needle on messaging, posturing. It was substance. It was 100% substance from beginning to end. So that's one thing that I think is a big takeaway. But the flip side of that is what we're also going to hear is that the success from, moderate establishment governors in governor's races in New Jersey and Virginia, that they won handily, depending on how the final turnout ends up, final tallies. We're talking, you know, 10, 12, 13 points to, you know,
in New Jersey, which that was supposed to be a nail biter and it didn't even come close.
That's right. And so what people are saying is, see, this is an example of you take, you know, traditional establishment figures, both of those women. First, let's start by saying they're both women. That's new ish. It's the second governor of New Jersey. That's a woman, first governor of Virginia. But they both had some degree of military pedigree in their work experience. So this is, there's a lesson, according to centrist Democrats, there's going to be a lesson on what type of candidates in this era will be, desirable, palatable, winning in some of these purple places where there's a mix of people that aren't like solid red or solid blue. So both of those stories are true. We saw what happened in Maryland. We saw what happened in New York City for the mayor's race, and we saw those two county races. So I'll hand it over to you. But I think that, you know, as we look at crosstabs on the demographics, it's going to get even fuzzier. Like there'll be even more variety in what people are saying the lessons were. But I think, you know, from a 30,000 foot view, it's really about power, right? Like you need to get power. And the way you get power is you build coalitions, and each place may have its own sort of strategy that makes the most sense, which means it really is an all of the above type scenario rather than listening to any one prognosis of what won, what was a winning strategy.
Sure. I'm going to talk about Virginia first, because that was one where 4 years ago, it did not go well for the Democrats. Biden was losing his popularity. I'm not sure if we were quite out of the pandemic yet, but inflation was starting to take off. And then, of course, the Democratic candidate for governor, you know, made the mistake of saying something like parents have no place in selecting curriculum. It wasn't what he meant to say, but it's what came out of his mouth and got you used against him. And so you had McAuliffe and the attorney general, forgetting who the current governor was,
Glenn Youngkin.
Glenn Youngkin, that's right. And he was a moderate, at least supposedly. And so here we have a race to replace Glenn Youngkin. In Virginia, by the way, you only get one term. So that's why Youngkin wasn't running. And you had legislator, the Spanbaker, am I saying that right? What's her name?
Spanberger.
Running, and she ran a great campaign, but she got a little bit bogged down because the candidate for Attorney General Jay Jones had written some really inappropriate emails that got leaked to the press about wanting to, you know, have certain Republican politicians killed and their whole families killed. And it was really dark humor. And, of course, because he didn't mean it, but still, it's just not the kind of thing you say even before Charlie Kirk was killed, you know, and it definitely was bad. And there was a backlash, calls for him to drop out, which he couldn't because he's on the ballot, right? I mean, he could say I dropped out, but that's about it. And pressure on Spanberger to revoke her endorsement of him. And there was a really odd moment in one of the debates where her opponent didn't even answer the question, just comes right out of the bat saying, how can you, you know, put up with this and not withdraw your endorsement? And why aren't you calling for him? And Spanberger just looked forward and ignored her the whole time and went on for, you know, there was like awkward silence. And so there was a lot of thought that not only was Jones going to lose, but he would drag the other ticket, the rest of the ticket with him. Didn't happen. Spanberger won handily, double digits. And Jones won by about 5 points the last time I took a look, which what I expected it to be closer. I thought maybe he would pull it out. So this means that people, when they're voting, well, for one thing, he did apologize. And so a lot of voters may have accepted that apology. But secondly, I think that voters were just feeling, particularly the Democrats, were just feeling, okay, we got a jerk of a candidate in there, but we can't give up this office right now. There's Trump has too much control as it is, and I think that's the factor. If Trump wasn't president, I think Jay Jones would have lost that race because I think the people are just too desperate. We can't afford to let him run the state, and especially not take the attorney general's office. That's my thought. You have thoughts on it?
I tend to agree with you that, like you said, the polling originally indicated that there was going to be a problem for his candidacy. And in fact, there is a problem, but problems are finite. And so the question, it was the unknown or the uncertainty. Typically, campaigns are very conservative and they'll say, well, we need to do something about this and get rid of this person. He's harmful to the team. In fact, when you look at the exit polls, just short of 1 in 10 Democrats did say that those comments were disqualifying. Yeah. Because adding violence to the political process is something no political figure can justify. But they still voted for him. So that's telling. That's basically saying 1 out of 10 people. Well, if you were trending towards losing, but you won relatively handily, that could be the marginal difference.
Yeah, I mean, I saw some interviews, and one person said, "Yeah, it should be Jay Jones should not be on the ballot because of that, because that's really inappropriate and dangerous. But we have a president who has 34 felony convictions. So what are we even talking about anymore? And he says all kinds of things indirectly that are kind of violent too, right? So it's kind of like, well, you know, this is just not the time to think about those things for some voters. And it is pretty amazing. I'm going to stick to Virginia for just a minute because I was looking for a silver lining for the Republicans last night. They lost across the board. I mean, it just, things didn't go. I mean, okay, there were some initiative referendums, I think, in Texas that went their way about taxes or something like that, and a couple things like that. That's Texas, but they lost ground in Virginia's legislature. The silver lining is it doesn't look like the Democrats are going to get a supermajority, but they're going to be pretty close to it. That's all I could come up with.
The good news for Democrats, they picked up 13 seats, but the good news for Republicans is that's not enough for absolute control.
Yeah, I mean that's about it. And then you go into New Jersey, and how do you say the Republican's name? Is it Sia Trelli?
I think in Italian that C is a CH in his name.
Okay.
So it's Chiatarelli.
Okay. I think he made a huge mistake because he was all in with Trump. It may have been a little closer anyways if he had done the Youngkin thing and said, I'm independent. I'll make my own decisions, and no, I don't endorse some of the things that Trump are doing. I don't know to the degree that it hurt in New Jersey, but going back to Virginia for just a sec, the northeastern corner was really impacted by DOGE. That's where a lot of federal workers live, that they commute into Washington, D.C., and they've been devastated. And I think there are some similar things going on in New Jersey, but he hitched a ride with Trump, and in a state like New Jersey, I don't know what he was thinking.
Yeah, so I've thought the same thing, that making it a referendum on people's embracing the Trump administration's agenda, that was a risk that he didn't need to take or make. But I think this is an example of groupthink, that that party, the Republican Party, now as we've talked about for years, that's the trend, that people are no longer independent, they're no longer bold. It's the president has the ability to make or break you. So you got to track pretty closely to him. One thing I want to point out about New Jersey that I noticed last night was, firstly, Mikey, Cheryl ended up getting better turnout at the county level than outperforming when Vice President Harris ran for president last year. That over at first the margin looked greater, but still a 5% advantage, even better than Governor Murphy last time around 4 years ago. But more to what you had anticipated, we're going to look at the crosstabs more. Yeah. You and I are going to talk about this more as more information becomes available. But I looked at I think it was CNN that pointed out that Passaic County is heavily Latino in New Jersey. And that's an area where Trump was +3 in last year. But last time I checked, Mikey, Cheryl was +10. So that's a 13-point swing in a heavily Latino district. So that could be, foreshadowing headwinds, or as other people are saying, that could mean that there are tailwinds behind Republicans to win back Latino folks from the pretty heavy shift, which was like, I think, 10 points or more last year, which was key to Trump's success in places like, you're probably going to mention this, places like the Texas border communities.
Right. Yeah, we'll get back to that in a minute. But talking about swings, this was in New Jersey, precinct in Edison, New Jersey. It's very South Asian. I have a friend who pays very close attention to how Indians and Pakistani origin people vote. And in this particular precinct, it was Trump plus 30 in 2024. And last night it was Cheryl plus 76. I don't know if that sets a record, but that is mind-boggling. Turnaround. That's
I got goosebumps. I hadn't heard that because I actually used to live there. I went to Rutgers University, and if you go across the river, there's a you know couple small communities that this is the district you're speaking to. My take on it is that there's very conservative ethnic pockets, including Asian. But that there's also a large university population there too. Mm-hmm. So professors and students, or, you know, in my case, continuing student for a long time, I lived there for a while. So anyway, my point is that, it's interesting to see that there was an appeal for Trump's message just as recently as last year from a lot of people, potentially small business owners, people that are pro family. Maybe they've had enough of this, that, or some other element of the Democratic Party, but that because of what's been happening for the last 9 months, there's a track record of evidence that people reassessed last night.
I mean, the heavy-handed deportation with ICE just going crazy, people dying, trying to flee from them, and the rest. I mean, you know, I tend to think that, hey, well, it's just us liberals that care about it. Everybody else is saying, well, don't be here, right? But not everybody is saying that. In California, there was a poll a couple of months ago that even Republicans, a slight majority, were not supporting the policy as it was being implemented. They wanted safe borders. They wanted a few other things, but they do not support what is happening on the streets. It's just too, you know, draconian. They don't support mass police, and they don't support just people just being grabbed, out of nowhere. There's that. There is inflation, the price of meat and everything, which they tend to get blamed for, although I don't know that many people were even talking about that. But the fact that farmers are going under, people do pay attention to the news because of the tariffs and because of lack of work. I mean, so all of these things that, you know, I sort of just think, well, MAGA's not going to care, or Red America is not going to care. Maybe they're starting to do that, in some situations, and particularly if they're of color. It may be that even the Latinos who are basically saying, yes, I came here the right way, they should come the right way, are looking at people who look like them being treated the way they are, and maybe it's having an effect. And this could not bode well in Texas, because what I'm told is that the remapping of Texas that California decided to try to offset basically assumed that Latinos would vote the same way in 2026 that they did in 2024. And maybe that was a very dangerous assumption.
Yeah, I know we've been talking about the election a bunch already, and we put a lot of time into it. And I think it's interesting that I reviewed a lot of the responses today to the election outcome. And so mm-hmm. It's not just what I spoke about earlier, which is Democrats saying, hey, you know, we did it. According to Nate Silver, it was a 10 out of 10. He put in place, he published rather a list of 18, you know, factors that one of the experts he consulted with. So one of the experts you and I go to went to an even greater expert and found that all 18 of those markers were hit. And so it really, that's why Nate Silver called it a 10 out of 10. But what I was going to say is that the response from the right, from Republicans generally, there's a lot of interesting elements there too. Maybe of course we're too close to the fire and people are still in that sort of fight or flight mode and they're still fighting. Was said by, like, you know, for example, Steve Bannon, he got ahead of this and said that, he was responding to Donald Trump saying, and so it begins. Basically, Trump was insinuating that President Trump is going to really, butt heads with, for example, Mayor Mamdani in New York City. So what Steve Bannon said was that what the Trump administration should do is target Mamdani's citizenship and naturalization process. Yeah. And if appropriate, if there's any evidence of anything that doesn't completely fit, you know, dot the I's, cross the T's standards, have him deported to Uganda. And what he said was, this is a quote, it ought to be addressed by the State Department, DHS, and the Justice Department to go through all this. If the guy lied on his naturalization papers, he ought to be deported out of the country immediately, put on a plane to Uganda. He also recommended that immediately, and which the party did, sue California for violating the California Constitution about the mid-cycle redistricting. And finally, this is more substantive. He said, focus on domestic populist issues, like actually engage the working class people on the affordability issue that it appears really is impacting everybody's lives in these exit surveys, amongst other data we have available to us. Affordability, cost of living is, you know, underline, exclamation point, what people are really, what's important to folks.
This threatening of your political enemies with, you know, looking at their papers. I mean, Stephen Miller's wife did it on television recently against Cenk Unger, saying, you know, when she was getting upset about an argument as it was getting heated, said, well, you better check your papers. My husband's going to be looking into it. And that just, it just led to outrage. And that might be the very kind of thing that, you know, led to these results yesterday. If that was the lesson to be learned, apparently, at least at the top of the leadership, it hasn't been learned. You would think when your party did so badly, and where every targeted flip was accomplished. Every single one that the Democrats put money in to flip, and whether it was a legislator or other one, was accomplished. I mean, 13 statewide races, including two in Georgia, the first time it's for a public service commission. But it, you know, so it's not a real important as important as some of the other positions, but it is the first time a Democrat has won a statewide non-federal race in over 20 years.
Exactly.
I mean, these results, and I want to go over a few before we go to the next topic, because there's a few things that are important that we haven't covered. But you would think, okay, what are we doing wrong? But they're not. At least there's no indication they are. I'm going to have a prediction of at the end of an impact that might happen with the Republicans, but I just want to point out that it extended into Philadelphia, where Republicans had targeted three justices of the Supreme Court, and failed miserably, even worse than normal. The Larry Krasner, possibly the most progressive or left-wing DA in a major city in America, won a third time. He's been targeted. You know, they thought that he would go out like the DA in San Francisco and other places, but he's been kind of successful. Murder rates and shootings are down in that city, whether it has to do with him or just the general trends that we've talked about. Who knows, or both. But he got reelected, and the people on school boards that had gotten in wanting to get materials, critical race theory and what they called pornographic materials that came in on that movement, 4 years ago, which is what helped Youngkin in Pennsylvania, a slew of them got knocked off the boards, the school boards. These are small things. Just real quickly, in Colorado, they overwhelmingly passed two measures geared towards free school meals. One that will come from a tax on anyone over $300,000, and another to basically tear into a surplus fund, and they're going to use it to basically make all school meals free. If you have any questions or comments, email us at redwoodwonk@gmail.com.
Listen to Rub and Wonk on KZZH 96.7 FM every Tuesday and Thursday night at 8 p.m.
In Maine, there was a voter suppression, had a lot of the same thing, requiring ID, you know, shutting down mail-in voting. It went down hard. to defeat. They also in Maine passed a gun control measure that probably will get struck down, even though basically what it does is if you've had too many restraining orders, you know, you don't get to own a gun, right? So we'll see. At every level, this was a successful election for Democrats. What is the thing that they had in common, the three? We've got this trifecta: the governor's race in New Jersey, governor's race in Virginia, and the mayor's race. Some statistician pointed out that over the past 90 years, that's only happened 5 times, and every single time the Democrats retook the House in the next election to have a sweep of those. But, you know, they're saying, well, is this a message for moderation, or is it a message for left-wing, you know, politics that Mamdani represents? What it is what all three did was they focused on the daily working lives, on affordability and all of that. It's not even, I don't think it's so much that even what your proposals are, is that you're addressing it. And that's something that the Democrats have apparently not adequately addressed, is people, the difficulties they are experiencing every day because of the volatility in the economy and other reasons. And that's the common theme there. Will the Democrats learn that lesson? We'll see.
I'll just kind of add my 2 cents about what you just said. Keep it short. You know, Ezra Klein, New York Times, who writes for them. He's an author. He's, you know, podcaster. I think he founded Vox. He's prominent with his book right now called Abundance, where he speaks about there are legitimate criticisms of governments being ineffective and how meeting the needs of people require more efficient government. So it's like it's a critique of Democrats kind of being a little bit overly in favor of regulation. I'm not giving it fair service to what he's actually saying, but in general, that's one of the topics that are making the rounds. And so he obviously speaks about many other things. He talks to lots of people. He's prolific. And one of the things he came out with over the weekend was all of the above. So there are going to be people like Mayor Mamdani who are out there saying, like, you know, we need to show the billionaires and the oligarchs that, you know, we focus on local issues, cost of living, working families, and this is how we fight this authoritarian as well as the future authoritarians that are going to, you know, use the current president's, approach to governance. And so he's saying, you listen a little bit to that, but also listen a little bit to those folks that are centrists that are saying, hey, in my community, what we need to do is we need to do it this way. So he's saying it's all of the above. But I do think cost of living and sort of, like you said, people standing up and acknowledging reality, saying they're going to do something about it and actually doing something about it, that's somewhat novel right now. So that's to a certain extent, that should be instructive for our future, leadership and governance.
All right. Before we go to the next topic, did I miss any important results?
No, I don't think so. I think we hit it all.
All right. So our next topic is, of course, it's not quite as big in the news, but it was big news, and then it was small news, and then it's going to get to be big again. But I also think this may have been a factor in the results last night. But SNAP benefits, are off. People are not receiving them. There were 2 district court orders that to use a reserve fund that is apparently meant for emergencies like this to fund SNAP, at least for a while. Trump first said he wasn't going to follow him, and then he said, oh, he was going to ask for court for guidance on how he could do it, and that turned out to be pure BS. And as of last night, yesterday morning at 8 a.m., Trump posted on Truth Social SNAP benefits, which increased by billions and billions of dollars, quote-unquote, manyfold, during the crooked Joe Biden's disastrous term in office, parentheses, due to the fact that they were haphazardly handed to anyone for the asking as opposed to those just in need, which is the purpose of SNAP, will be given only when the radical left Democrats open up government which they easily can easily do, and not before. Thank you for your attention to this matter, President DJT. Zero Dark 20, I don't know who that is, but he said, but it posted in response, an American president was ordered to feed Americans. He's fighting that. Let that sink in. And so basically, yeah, you have the message, and I think voters are getting it or getting the gist of it, is unless you give in and let us take healthcare coverage away from the working class Americans, I'm going to starve them. I mean, that's the message he's sending, right? I mean, it just, you know, it boggles the mind that he thought that was going to be popular. I wonder if posting that yesterday morning lost some votes right then and there. But this is the shutdown is going on, not much negotiation, at least not publicly, and Trump doesn't feel like he has to do it. Dave? All right, that's good.
I think that's important. Thank you for the setup. There's approximately at any given time about 42 million people receiving SNAP benefits. That's one out of every eight people. That means that because of their income, they don't have enough money to put food on the table for their families every month. So I think that's important to see, like, and it's concentrated in certain, you know, pockets too. But it affects every community. But we saw, like, similar to healthcare, that I saw recently that, like, some huge number of Inland Empire in California, so that those rural conservative leaning red districts, communities in the eastern part of the state, that some people think that somehow food stamps are predominantly city folks getting it, but it's really everybody. It affects all communities. So what we're seeing here is the idea is that, hey, we talked about this last week, there's a fund set up that would be able to get at least some money to people. It's a little over $4.5 billion. But mm-hmm. food stamps cost our country $9 billion a month. So right. What the administration is saying is, you know, we plan on following the rules, but we have to change it. Sorry, the judge's ruling. But we have to lower it by half because we only have half as much money in this fund that you guys are pointing to. But because that requires an investment in how you deliver half of a fund, it's going to take time. So the administration kind of gets to have it both ways right now, where they get to say they're going to follow the rules, but they don't actually have to distribute funds because they can say, look, we don't have a system in place right now that will deliver half payments to people. So that's, you know, just to show that there's a degree of cruelty behind it. The U.S. Department of Agriculture also said grocery stores are banned from giving discounts to SNAP recipients. So there were some people, so there were some people out there saying, hey, I own a store, or I'm an executive and making decisions at this food distribution company, a grocery store of some kind, and maybe we'll just do the right thing and try to alleviate the burden for some people. But our administration has decided we don't want you to reduce the cost of food to SNAP recipients. In fact, we want to ban it.
Is that even legal? I mean, why should a grocery store even listen to it? Does the president have that kind of power to order grocery stores instead of their prices?
Well, it's federal funds through a federal program administered by the executive branch. So there might be rules and precedents and laws and lawyers and judges and, the typical things that you point to when you say, can they do that? But really, this administration's shown that it's got power. And in fact, Carolyn Leavitt, the PR spokesperson, she said the White House considers it an unacceptable risk to use any other money. So even if there were people that were going to say, hey, why don't you tap into some other funds, like Vought, CBO chair, director Vought has the power to set priorities for what they're going to do with the limited amount of funds that they still have available to them. But what they're saying is, we decided we're not going to move money from any other fund to make that payment whole.
Which is what other presidents have done in past they moved money from funds to cover the military wages and the SNAP benefits.
Yeah, exactly. So as far as I'm concerned, I don't want to beat this to death, but there is a calculation going on for both Democrats and Republicans about, do we continue to keep the government shut down, meaning so that that money is not available, so that SNAP will continue to, you know, pay only one half in November and then maybe zero in December. Are we going to keep on this path, or are we going to do something different? And I think it's interesting that both parties are doing the calculation and trying to say to themselves, we're winning this, or I think we're winning this. And, you know, maybe we just continue this because it's going to hurt the other side worse. I've got a little bit of an insight about where I think this is going to go, but do you have any feedback on that at all about how the SNAP benefits will affect shutdown?
Yeah, the end of the show, but I'll just say it now. I think the election is going to have, it's obviously not having an effect on Trump, but I do think that there are going to be, the Republicans don't want to go down with the ship. And especially if they've got tough elections coming up in 2026, I think there is going to be some serious movement towards setting aside the shutdown, and probably within the next week or so. I think that is going to be, and then they get to look like heroes, and they're going to be holding this Trump, having basically wanting people to starve. And saying it out loud practically, that's going to have an impact. And I think between that and the New Jersey election, you know, the Republicans, I mean, we've seen this before, right? We were all talking about the great divorce when DeSantis was going to be the president, right? And Republicans were going to stand up to him, but they do, and then they get slapped down, and then they back off. But I think that we might be at a threshold now where we've got some pretty serious things going on that this election shows that even your base isn't happy, because maybe not many MAGA people voted for these Democrats, but maybe they didn't turn out even worse than normal. That's my thought.
Yeah. I think that this, obviously none of this happens in a vacuum, and we learned new information last night about, you know, people's, at least some marginal amount of the population's rejection of the status quo that we're seeing in voter shift. We're seeing an increased turnout. Obviously, we're seeing in across the board sweep in the limited amount of elections that occurred yesterday. What some of the Democrats are starting to, you know, rally around the idea that was put forth, I think, yesterday or this morning, rather, by Senator Blumenthal. He said ending the shutdown without a commitment from the president and Speaker Johnson would be a betrayal of all we've been fighting to uphold. Yeah. And so he said, we're winning the hearts and minds of the American people. We've come this far and the American people seem to be with us. And Bernie Sanders, Senator Sanders, was there too. And he said, accepting a meaningless vote would be a horrible policy decision. When you cave, you lose. He's basically saying there's no incentive for us to cave. It's hard for anyone to argue the message from voters is please cave for, right now.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I was just going to say that the alternative, though, is that there is a working group right now who is there are Republicans and Democrats speaking to each other, and what they've proposed is that we reopen the government through December, which has happened in as many of these budget debates as I can recall. Obviously, you know, it's not the same national climate that we've had for all those 18 right. or however many shutdowns we've lived through. But the deal is, what they're saying is that you open it up through December, knowing that there's some commitment on both sides. However, if they choose to, you know, honor their commitments, that that they reopen and then tee up votes for a full year of funding to pay for veterans benefits, agriculture programs, nutrition programs, and to keep Congress running. So this compromise position is, hey, let's give ourselves Thanksgiving, let's give ourselves Christmas. Like, let's have some normalcy when people need it the most, and we'll figure out something we could do shut down most of the government for a year, but keep open the parts of the government that take care of hungry people and soldiers and the veterans and food and to keep the government going. So that's the compromise they're working on. I just don't see that as really a win for anybody. It's really just a way to get the government open sooner so that the Republicans can kind of stop the bleeding. And even Trump himself has basically, you know, insinuated that that's not, he wants potentially the Senate to nuke the filibuster and just railroad through his budget without any compromise at all on the healthcare costs, and subsidies.
A lot of progressive Democrats would love that to happen. They would see that as a silver lining. I mean, so it's just because once they do that, it's going to be used, that the nuclear option is going to be used more often. If you have any questions or comments, email us at redwoodwonk@gmail.com.
You can listen to Rev. Wonk on KZZH 96.7 FM every Tuesday and Thursday night at 8 p.m.
That's it. You know, it happens that way. So, you know, Republicans better hope they never lose the Senate again. Sometimes they're acting like they aren't, you know, it's just, that way. I did have a discussion with a prominent local Republican this morning. It was actually online, his take was, well, these are all blue states. This is just, you know, this is just Democrats ranting, first of all, Pennsylvania, I wouldn't call a blue state. I'd say it's purple. I mean, you know, it goes to Trump, but secondly, you're not looking at the details. If you look at Virginia, I think you even pointed it out. Every county, every district went that way. So there were plenty of districts that the Republican candidates won, but not by as much as they have in the past. So it's affecting them because lack of health care and lack of SNAP benefits affects a lot of their constituents. They don't seem to have grasped that yet. And a lot of people, you know, in MAGA and the rest didn't understand that the health care coverage they were getting was Obamacare, right? You know, I mean, so they're maybe starting to think this through. And I don't know. I mean, the question is, you know, do Republicans, are they ever going to stand up to Trump? And this would be the moment to do it.
This should also be the moment for us to pivot over to talk about his suffering dementia, because I know we just have a few minutes left.
Yeah, okay. We saw that trip. We talked about the trip to Asia and how he acted. We're seeing these crazy posts that he's doing that are actually kind of crazier than normal, as even that it's hard to say. I mean, there are numerous people in the mental health care industry, experts, that are saying that he's showing the four signs of dementia. At one point, does this become a serious discussion in the media? Because, man, they went all over it with Biden. And they just seem to let things go. 60 Minutes actually edited the last part of their interview because he totally went unhinged in a way that's just not normal. It's a little bit of controversy with CBS, but that's a whole other topic we'll have to discuss another time. But what do you have to say about the topic, Dave?
So I mean, there's a lot here and wish we had more time. I'm sure we'll continue to cover this, but I think I may have read some of the things written by one of the same specialists you did. His name is he's a psychologist named Dr. John Gardner, and so he was a professor of psychiatry at Johns Hopkins University Medical School, and he did, and I think it's the same person. He talked at length in the past about some of Trump's kind of, you know, mental, his state, but that his most recent comments were, it's not just that he, you know, he's malignant narcissist, which is a potential fatal flaw, but that in fact, his judgment isn't just terrible, it's now also erratic, and that you can see those signs that his medical condition is worsening. Because when you get one of those MoCA cognitive tests, That's to screen if you have dementia. And he said, it's never the case, as in like zero, that you get you will get a battery of tests and an MRI unless they're concerned. Usually it's an annual test. But so there's nothing routine or normal unless doctors suspect severe cognitive decline or dementia. He went through a long list of things, but basically that what they're looking for is a deterioration between when they established a baseline and the present. They're looking for language, behavior, memory, and he's showing gross deterioration in all of them. So they talk, there's a whole bunch of examples of each that he pointed out. And he said, you know, the Trump that you see now, dementia doesn't get better. It only gets worse. And so there is a difference that, you know, you and I, sometimes you have trouble finding the words you're looking for, but there's a big difference between that and when there is really no logical connection between your words. So your words become disorderly, disjointed. And so, you know, Trump calls it the weave when he's saying this is my style. But some of these examples that we've seen in the last few weeks, it's really disheartening that an incomplete thought doesn't, you know, that a complete thought doesn't make it through a whole range of sentences. And I'll say one last thing here, because I know we have limited time. He's saying the real story here isn't that there is an impairment. The real story is that it's unreported that our president regularly and repeatedly represents our interest, but instead is really, you know, his words are babbling nonsense. So maybe you and I will dig a little bit more into it, because I know that's a bold claim, and it's harmful to introduce that out into our conversation with our friends and colleagues and neighbors that you know this is a real problem that no one's willing to even talk about. But I think it ought to be talked about.
And that's all the time we have on that. So we'll be picking up on that in the future. All right, so that brings us to predictions. Dave, what do you have for us?
Following up on some of the things I've mentioned in our conversation today and trying to keep it relatively short for now, I think that the election results from last night, as people kind of unpack what happened and try to figure out the best path to move forward, what we're going to see is that the Democratic Party really is reaching a moment of intense internal division. We've known that since Bernie was sidelined. We've known that for a long time. But now we're seeing successful paths to power using both the status quo centrist approach and a more visionary working class approach. And what my takeaway from this is that we're going to see some really challenging primary races where the party is struggling to define itself, and we'll see, since both the centrists and the progressives think that they have the better, can build a better mousetrap, we're gonna see them really engage in some intense competition for 2026.
Mamdani has probably encouraged a lot of progressives now.
Yeah.
Although he's a special case. I don't know if you got to see his after speech, his acceptance speech, but it was like Obama-esque. I mean, it was really well done. All right. Well, I'm going to go kind of just expand a little on the prediction that I've already talked about. I do think that and I've said this before, so this is me being loosey with the football with Charlie Brown, but I do think that Republicans there are Republicans who don't want to go down with the ship, who don't want their careers to end because of this. And they're looking at it. This is the first hardcore data that has gone against them. This election just, everybody, every area moved in the opposite direction. I do think that the Republicans are going to pick up the talk to talk about ending the shutdown if their leader doesn't. And I do think that they're going to start pushing back a little bit on some of the more extreme aspects of the policy, because otherwise they have lost the Latino vote. And they cannot win in 2026 if Latinos vote like they did last night. Well, we'll find out if any of this actually comes true. But till next time, stay informed and stay engaged.